this internet, God, I don't even know what the hell happened.
You sound good now.
I think initially, I think two things were going on. I went away for a week and I had left Batman running in the background. And I think Core Audio Demon just sort of ate itself to pieces, like over the course of the time. And then my network just wouldn't come up. Anyway, I'm so sorry.
You sound good now though.
Good. Well, hopefully we can hold this together until we can, you know, actually have a conversation.
None of this will actually happen in edited time.
Perfect. So, Mikhail, sorry. I like you a lot because it seems like nobody likes you.
Thank you.
No, by which I mean we'll get through it as we go through your history. Can you kind of sort of tell us how you got into doing the whole computer thing in the first place?
Into computers in the first thing?
Well, you know, just how you got onto your career path. Because I know one of the earlier things you did was Linux-based Norton Commander clone, right? Midnight Commander.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, I was definitely inspired. Well, first of all, I've always loved programming. So for a while, I did little shareware utilities in assembly language. That's what I used to do. And then I
always on Linux. Were you always a Linux guy?
No, this was a DOS. This is back in the DOS days. So I used to build DOS applications and resident. They were called terminated and state resident applications, and those were shareware applications. And then I created a security system for DOS that gave like an ACL based security system for DOS system. So you could say only my friends can look at this directory. Only these other people can look at that directory. And I made that a commercial product. And that was my first contact with the business industry.
Wow. That's a pretty serious hack on top of DOS.
It was an interesting hack, but I remember that the amount of money that I got out of this was something like 2% or 3% on each sale. And, because the distributor would take 50% and 50%, you know, 20% here, 20% there. So at the end of the day, I was very disappointed with this. Again, I was very young. I was probably 18 or so.
Box sales? Like you're selling?
Yeah, there were box sales. Yes, absolutely. It was a box product sold in Mexico. And, I still managed to make some good money, but I was thinking I'm getting 2 or 3% on this. This is really not for me. And there was, you know, the guy had a good explanation as to why I was receiving so little. So around this time, I started reading. I still love programming, but I read Richard Stallman's GNU Manifesto. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's always very interesting to, it's very easy to get engaged when you have a big vision of what the future could be. And I had a talent, which was I can write code. I'm pretty good. And this commercial stuff hasn't really been that great for me. I was actually making more money teaching, you know, kids math and programming. So I figured I'll just do open source, and the money will just come from teaching kids math and programming. So that's what I did for many years. I taught kids and I did open source on the side, motivated by Richard's whole free software initiative. So that's what I did open source for many years. And and around this time, there's a whole Linux explosion. Linux takes off a few years later. Mm-hmm. There's a Red Hat IPO by 99. So the Midnight Commander that you mentioned was 1992. So I worked for many years on open source, and then it became mainstream, and it became a source of maybe that's where the future is going to be.
Right.
By 99, Red Hat had the IPO, and everybody thought in a decade there's going to be 10% of the Fortune 500s are going to be open source companies. And at the time, we were true believers that we could help make the Linux desktop succeed. So our company really was focused on the Linux desktop. And our first product was building an email client. We're trying to fill the gaps in the Linux space. There was a spreadsheet already. We had a word processor project going on, Abby Word. We did the email client, and we started to put the things together. Mm-hmm. And we thought this is going to be very successful. But, you know, we learned the hard way a couple of things that the greatness and the benefits of open source are also their weakness. So what ended up happening, you know, through the years was, a very interesting fight between all the people that has had a stake on the Linux world. So we ended up in a very ugly situation where Linux got fragmented, and whoever was on top that year really was not interested in standardizing anything. So first it was Red Hat, then it was Ubuntu. So whenever you were on top, the idea of standardizing and commoditizing your product was out of the question. So whenever we said, hey, let's use the Red Hat base and then everybody builds on top, that never went anywhere.
Right. So, was that just like turf warfare or?
Yeah, everybody thought that they needed to own it. I mean, it was very interesting, sociologically speaking, to see how everybody thought we need to own this. We have a stake in the ground. And there was certainly that element, so a business element to this. And there was also an element of not invented here, or we can build a better version. So this whole idea of we can, you know, we want to give people choice. I mean, it sounds, it's great, a great bumper sticker,
but, yes.
Yeah. But it was very difficult to make it work. There was a lot of fragmentation, a lot of frustration. And most importantly, the other thing that, so it didn't really crystallize a business around the Linux desktop. There were a couple of successes, but nothing really major. And I remember while we were working at Novell that, we felt, we were always under pressure to get funds to solve another problem. So can we solve the media playback problem, right? Can we license the codecs for, VC1 or MPEG or MP3 or
which AAC. Itself was, I imagine, a political fight just simply because of the patents and the fact
there was that, and it became a battle because this was technology that was licensed, so it couldn't really be contributed back to open source. So even if you're trying to fix these issues, they involved a lot of money, and of course, the Linux desktop is not producing money; it's being funded out of other things. So so it became problematic. And in the meantime, you see people like Apple that were investing heavily on their products. And you can see the relationship, right? If it's proprietary, you make money, you invest back in the software. And we're trying to, we did all this work, and then somebody else would ship it with no revenue flowing back to the developers, right?
This, so this is right around the OS X sort of introduction, right? 2000, like late 90s, early 2000s.
Well, by 2003, the split was very apparent, but sure. it lasted since the very beginning. I mean, at different levels of engagement and different levels of success from 1999 to, 2010, which is when I kind of stopped paying a lot of attention to Linux desktop. For a decade, there were ups and downs and fights and lack of funding and we never saw really in that decade, we never saw, another 10 or 20 or 30 companies, open source companies making it to the Fortune 500. So that was an interesting, it was a fascinating experience. I mean, there's no question that we learned a lot, and there was no question that we did our best, and a lot of the work that we did is still usable today. So it was a great gift to the world, but it's difficult to make it sustainable, and it's difficult to to pay engineers to work on this thing and solve big problems.
Right. Now, one of the things during that period that you also involved with was also probably a bit of a third rail in terms of the open source community, but you became involved with Mono, which is an open source implementation of Microsoft's .NET platform.
Right. And that happened because we had just built this email client I mentioned, and it was written in C, C++. It was multi-threaded, multi-process. And you have to remember that when we started this project in 1999, the Linux stack wasn't as developed as it is today. You have to remember there were no working threads implementations. There were different threading implementations, but nothing that you can call POSIX thread compliant. So everything that we take for granted today, like, oh yeah, you can use POSIX threads and they will work the way that the man page says. Those kinds of things didn't exist in 1999. So we had been very frustrated. It was hard to debug. It was, machines were not very powerful. C applications crash, C++ application crash. You make a mistake and you get memory corruption. It's very difficult to track these problems down. So the project was late. It was painful to develop, not very enjoyable. And then Microsoft came up with this C# thing, and they submitted it to ECMA for standardization, and it later became an ISO standard. So we looked at that, and we got a little jealous. We thought these guys are going to get a fabulous development platform, and we're still you know, putting things together with strings and you know, duct tape.
Yeah.
We tried to use higher level languages like Python, but remember, this is the year 2000. Building a large application in Python is out of the question. It's just too slow. Mm-hmm. Interpreters are just not worth using at this point. So there were different days. So that's when we started the Mono project. It was, let's bring this amazing piece of technology that Microsoft has developed, which was essentially a better Java. So they took Java. They fixed all the things that Sun was unwilling to fix, and they shipped their own system. So we took that to Linux, and of course, people thought that it was always a conspiracy from Microsoft.
Trojan horse, right? Backdoor to finally stop Linux on the desktop. Was that a reach to have to go outside of sort of the community and go to Microsoft, which at the same, you know, people thought of it as the bad guy at the time. I think probably less so now, hopefully less so now. But
the open source, what happened with the free software community is that there were people coming in from different angles. There were technologies, there were people that cared about freedom, but there was also a large contingent of people that just downright hated Microsoft, right? So on the one hand, there were people that believe in free software for Richard Stallman's freedoms. There were people that believe in open source because of the technical advantages, or people that enjoyed it. But there was this contingent of people that just downright hated Microsoft, and they were a dominant voice. And when you have the dominant voice, it very quickly became the main discussion point. So for years, we couldn't really get any traction.
Well, it's hard to talk about the technology when people are just yelling at you about the politics behind it, or...
That's right. So, so it's interesting because by the end of the life of Mono in the open source world or in the Linux space, I could count with two hands the number of large important applications built with Mono on Linux. I'm not going to name them, but they're seven or eight big apps, and we were very proud of them. It's like, well, this is big success. We have seven or eight big apps built with it. But now that we're doing mobile applications, that people use Mono for mobile applications, we just cannot, I don't even know how many there are. They're measured in the tens of thousands. I thought I could just, keep up with them and download every app and, you know, say, hey, you could do this, or you could use this API. It would make your app better. And I did it for a while, but at one point, I don't even keep track of them anymore.
Right.
There are just too many.
So yeah, let's talk about Xamarin for a bit. I'm gonna go out on a limb and say it's the second largest development environment for iOS, certainly, and probably for Android too. You think that's fair to say?
Actually, I don't have stats. I mean, I don't know how we compare to other environments. I would say Flash seems to be a very important thing for people to still publish apps in those two environments. Unity 3D for games, I think it's uncontested, a very large.
Yeah, I should say, I'm counting Unity as.
Yeah, as Mono, yes.
Because Mono, right?
So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If you count Unity, it's definitely, you know, they're a huge, huge player. And there's a couple of others. I'm happy that, you know, our mission kind of transformed from bringing free software to the masses to deliver great developer tools. And when we started the company, I told Nat, I want to build objects of desire. And you've done it a few times before. That's what we want to build. We want to build the best developer tools that we can. Can we make this happen? And our mission became, let's make developers incredibly happy. Because we thought, you know, Apple's strategy is to make the consumer very happy. That's their goal. That's their mission in life. Make the consumer happy. Google's goal with Android was, let's make the OEMs happy, right? Let's make the telcos adopt those and let's make the phone manufacturers happy. And we've been working on Mono for a long time and we thought, well, what is our mission? Our mission is to make developers happy. And we'll make developers happy in those two platforms. So, you know, Apple will keep the users happy. We'll make their developers happy. So that's a driving force behind the company.
I do think it's kind of amusing that Android has kind of basically brought a lot of open source stuff to the masses in a way that Linux never quite managed to.
Yeah, it is very interesting. Yeah.
It's not quite the same thing, but I mean the basis and sort of a lot of the a lot of it's similar.
Yeah, it's fascinating because we thought that we could make open source matter by doing a frontal assault on the two established players, right? Mm-hmm. Microsoft and Apple. That was the vision. Let's replace Windows. Let's replace the Mac. I don't think we ever thought we were going to completely conquer the world, but we thought, hey, if we can get 30% of the market, 30%, 30%, 30%, we'll be very happy changing the world in that shape. And the reality is that Linux just happened in a different space. The full frontal assault really didn't make a lot of sense. It was better to fill in a niche elsewhere. And I was just talking to a friend recently and he said the same thing. Full frontal assaults rarely work. It's much better to work on other spaces and try to deliver value in different ways.
I don't think the effort was foolhardy per se, because I think it's easier to sort of pick up a flag and wave it when you have a clear full frontal, like this is, we are going to recreate, a Mac-like, Windows-like environment in a totally free way. So I can see what, as a rallying cry, I think it works great. I just find it amusing that, almost where you didn't concentrate is where the sort of the bigger successes of Linux have come from.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing that makes it easier to say, we're going to go and fight with those guys or we're going to do something like that. The full frontal assault has one advantage. Somebody already has done all the product management for you. Somebody has figured out when you print, you have to do file print. And this is what the dialogue should show. It should show number of pages. Do you want to sort them by this? Do you want to print four pages per page? Do you want to change the collation order, right? Somebody already did the work. So it is a lot simpler to say, oh, I can do that. I can do that better. Then come out and say, well, that's an interesting problem, but why don't we build that system that connects, people walking down the street or something, right? Now you have to do all the PMing. You have to do research. You have to do multiple attempts. You have to fail. You have to iterate. So kind of copying has that advantage. Copying is, what the other person has and you can go and say, well, I can do a better job at that guy did, which is very different than having to build something from the ground up.
Right.
So it's easier to come up with a new car. It's difficult to invent a new system of transportation.
Right. Superrail. What was that thing? What was that Elon Musk's thing?
Exactly.
Yeah. So what I do like about, there's a lot of things I like about Xamarin, but I don't think you fall into that trap where you do a full frontal assault on it. You don't try to replace Xcode.
Right. I mean, in fact, I would say that if people are happy with Objective-C and they're happy with Xcode, they should keep using what makes them happy. We're really not in a fighting mood, but, there's a lot of people that like C# or F# as a language.
Mm-hmm.
And the benefits that come with that are either because they have previous experience or because they like innovations that Microsoft had brought to the platforms. And, that's a big enough, it's a very big market. And we're very happy to address that one. Of course, I'm not going to complain if an Objective-C developer becomes enamored with C#, but,
right.
It's such a big space that there's really no point in trying to convince people to move.
Right. And one of the benefits of, I suppose, Mono is that it can be embedded in something like the Unity 3D game system.
That is correct. Right. Mono is a library, right? So you can put in an existing application. So you can extend an application or you can make Mono drive your existing libraries and APIs.
Yeah. So can we actually sort of describe how it works?
The Mono runtime?
Yeah, the Mono runtime with the CLR and sort of the way that code gets added to it and executed.
Yeah, it's...
We got a pretty nerdy crew, but I mean, yeah, so, you don't need to get super low level.
So Mono provides, I mean, the Mono runtime actually provides a couple of services to applications. It provides garbage collection, threat management and threat pools. It provides an abstraction to the underlying IO system, provides a Unicode environment, and provides a core set of libraries that have been designed with threat safety in mind. So there's a very strong design in .NET around around threading and helping people develop threaded applications. And there's a progression for how low level you want to go from the very simple threat operation to the threat pools to just let the system do it for you, which is this thing that Microsoft calls async. And it's very often confused with, oh, async, that Node.js thing, right? Or those are callbacks. Actually, what Microsoft has done is they've made it so that compilers rewrite your what would otherwise be linear code into callback-based code. Mm-hmm. So you write code the same way that you would write a linear console application with no callbacks at all. All you do is you insert this little word called await, and then the compiler rewrites your code, preserving state, preserving flow of execution, preserving error handling, preserving exceptions, and it all happens transparently. So,
similar, can you contrast that to an Objective-C block?
Well, the problem with the block is that it's asynchronous, right? So you do things like enumerate objects and then you give it a block, which means that the little piece of code will be called at one point. Or for example, an event handler, it will be called at one point. But basically in your method, you have code that executes at one during one timeline, another one that executes at another one. And you kind of have to keep up with those two environments. Two levels is probably not that difficult. The problem usually happens when you do things like open the database. Then when you're finished opening the database, download this file. Then when you're done doing that, then do this thing as you're chaining the operations.
Right. Yeah.
And you have a block inside a block inside a block inside a block inside a block. And the problem in general here is how do you pass state between these environments? But most importantly, how do you handle errors? So if you're down three or four levels down of error handling or of blocks, how do you propagate that error and how do you unwind the problems in higher levels? And I can tell you what I did back before we had this technology from Microsoft is sometimes you handle the errors and sometimes you say, hey, sorry, couldn't do it.
Right.
And you try to abort the whole transaction.
Yeah.
You didn't necessarily need to abort the whole thing, but you kind of give up at one point. Because it becomes very cumbersome. Mm-hmm. So you become a bit of a glorified accountant when you're doing these nested blocks.
So the await keyword, does that effectively just suspend the thread?
Exactly. So the await keyword says, hey, this thing might or might not have completed. If it hasn't completed, suspend the thread. It's actually more complicated than that. But because there's no threads involved, it suspends the execution. Because the compiler rewrites your code, transfers control back to the caller, and if you have this, if you have await inside awaits, it goes all back to your main loop, so you continue execution. When something resumes execution, so let's say that the network data arrived, the system automatically resumes the execution of your pipeline at the point that you left it.
Right.
So it resumes execution at that point. You can handle errors in a traditional way. That, oh, there was an error. Well, I should do this or return this value or do something like that. And await again if you need to. And it will again suspend the execution of your entire call stack.
So that's great. We did, like years ago, I embedded Lua into a game project.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have sort of, basically cooperative threads of Lua. So, you know, the UI, you decide to walk to some place and then wait for 2 seconds and then go and do something else. And it made the scripting programs incredibly easy to read and write. Because you just literally say, this is what I want to do. Just figure it out.
Yes, that is exactly the principle. So they did it at the language level. So you write code in a very linear way. right? If the user, if the, you know, you write loops, you say, while the username is, the username and password are not correct, you know, just keep looping, right? So you write code like, A equals get username, await, get password. If they're different, just loop back, right? And if you have to do this with blocks, it gets very complicated, right?
No, with this way, you can literally write the very first basic program you ever wrote.
Exactly.
And pretty much just work.
Yeah. Exactly. And it becomes asynchronous. And Microsoft has this rule, right? They have this rule on Windows RT where they say, in fact, we're not going to give you synchronous APIs anymore since the compiler can rewrite the stuff for you. Any API that can take more than 50 milliseconds, right? So any API that we know could potentially take 50 milliseconds because you're accessing the disk or accessing the network or it's a computation, we're not even going to give you a synchronous way of doing it. So in fact, Windows RT no longer lets you say open file and read bytes and none of that. All of those are gone. You only get the asynchronous version. So you say open and you have to wait. So you say await open, await read, await this, await that. And that ensures that applications are always responsive. So you never end up in a position where the application is not transferring control back to the main loop and handling user input.
It sounds like a great idea to me. And also something that's probably kind of hard to map back into like a C-based language.
I think it can be done. Especially the big trick is that you really want a garbage collector for all the bookkeeping. But I think it could be done. In fact, I think it would be a very interesting research project to do this. But I think it can be done. And it's a matter of teaching the compiler to rewrite the code for you. So I can see a day where Objective-C could get this thing. I don't think it's out of the question, or Java, or any other language. It takes work, and there's a lot of details that need to be taken care of. And that's what Mono and the .NET runtime really give you. But it's completely, I mean, I think it's within the human reach there, even for C or C++.
Sure. To me, it would seem that running on a CLR, like a runtime, would enable this kind of stuff a lot easier than just sort of, I mean.
It is like, the GC. I have to say, the GC is the magic trick that enables a lot of scenarios that are otherwise become very cumbersome for everyone. All the bookkeeping becomes very cumbersome. And so it's really the garbage collector that enables that. Because you have to remember, on iOS, we don't actually run a VM. All you end up is with the very basic services, garbage collection, thread management, the state management, these APIs, but there's no JIT. We have to compile statically to, we just use LVM, right? So we pass this to LVM and we say, this is a code that you have to compile. So we rewrite your code in advance, right? So you write this cute little code where you say, await open, await read file. And by the time the LVM backend sees this code, we already rewrote all of your code to be, you know, callback based.
Right. So it's interpreting the LLVM bytecode rather than, I mean, it can't JIT, right? And on Android, you guys JIT?
On Android, we do JIT. We're planning on adding a static compiler as well, but right now we JIT. And that has the advantage that you can do everything you can in .NET, right? In iOS, you're limited because you cannot do dynamic code generation, right? It's something that .NET people like to do. They generate code dynamically, or they load code dynamically, or, you know, they download an extra library, plugins on demand. So all those things you just can't do on iOS. You can do it on not on iOS.
I'm coming around to the idea that JIT is probably a good future for languages in general. I think maybe 10 years ago when the CLR stuff came out and like Mono was, or .NET, I think I was still a little bit, it just seemed like an added level of abstraction that you didn't really need. Because I was in Objective-C at the time, and it felt like, well, I can have my nice objects, and I can go and play with all the dirty bits, too. But the more you look at compute power and the way it's sort of morphing, the more legit kind of makes sense. Because you could retarget what chip you're running on, too, right? You could run it on you could JIT it to a small microprocessor, and then when you've got a lot of power, you can just move it to a more beefy.
That is correct. Yes.
You can do a lot of interesting stuff. And I guess memory locations aren't necessarily pointers, right? They're looked up by a handle in the JIT, I suppose.
No, we don't use. Well, that's the way that Java did it many years ago. That is that is the first good pass. That was okay in 1995, but these days GCs are a lot, they're a lot more sophisticated. Now these days we use a precise GCs. That means that, at any point, the program, they're maps. They're basically maps that describe any possible object on the heap. So we're able to look at an object and say, oh, well, we know the format of this object. We know which fields are objects, which fields are just data like integers, right?
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so when you do a collection, you do a precise scan of the heap, and you say, "Oh well, we know exactly what this thing is."
Oh, because you know so much more about the layout of the object, and you've
But it takes more time, right? So that's it. Actually, took us about 5 years to implement this. Initially, we had a very simple GC, the BOEM GC, conservative collector, which I think is similar to what Apple had.
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure they based it off the same thing.
Yeah, but and it's an okay first pass, but. You know, most modern systems like Java and .NET just use a more use state-of-the-art GC, which it just takes a lot longer to build. That's it. It's just more sophisticated, burns more cycles, you know, more programmer cycles. So instead of being a hack that you can put together in a month, it takes, you know, it took us 5 years.
Right.
But we're very happy with the result.
And so how's the power efficiency in online? Because I know that was sort of one of the issues with moving Apple's GC, which I think was, again, it was a BOEM-based one somehow. They didn't want it anywhere near iOS. Clearly, you guys have no problem running it on mobile devices.
Yeah, I mean, I've never... I always thought that that reason was a little bit... I suspect the problem had to do with the conservative collection. I don't really know. I mean, to be honest, whenever we measured it, the GC was never a problem for us, even when we used the conservative collector. It was really never the problem. I'm sure that Apple had good reasons, but I don't have their data. And I don't know what challenges the Objective-C runtime posed for them. I mean, Mono used the, when we use a conservative collector, we usually use it in semi-precise mode. So I guess maybe that made a difference and maybe that's something that they couldn't do. But we've never really found it. Now, there's a real disadvantage to GCs. I mean, there's no question that having a GC has the problem of the pauses, right?
Right.
If you create a lot of garbage and you need to allocate more memory, the GC at one point says, hey, listen, I'm just going to stop you right there for a second while I clean this up. So there is that disadvantage.
I was going to ask, does .NET lend itself to allocating many small objects? Like each int is an object kind of thing?
Well, so ints are never objects. That's a big difference between Java and .NET. And it's actually one of the biggest differences between the Java runtime and the .NET runtime, which is that .NET has a notion of a structure versus an object. And like C++, you can do whatever you want with both of them. The difference is that a struct is always allocated on the stack. So when you say int A, all we do is we just allocate a slot on the stack, right? Yeah. There's no allocating in the heap. Yeah. So it's really never managed by the garbage collector.
That's interesting. That's a good trade-off because the stack is easy to just
That's right. And that means that, for example, if you create, you know, CGREX, the equivalent of a CGRect, right? The equivalent in Java is actually this tiny little object that contains the rectangle. In .NET, there's no such tiny little object. There's just
four floats or whatever on there. Yeah.
Exactly. On the stack.
That's cool. That's interesting.
So it is never... And we see this a lot happening between Android and iOS. You have applications that work great on iOS, you know, a simple API that uses rectangles, like CGRects, and the equivalent version of Android that uses the rectangle API, but it's an object. So you end up creating thousands of junk objects, right?
Tiny allocations that are just,
Exactly. And, you know, that puts a lot of pressure into their GC. So .NET reduces the pressure on the GC just by having this notion of structures, right? So once you port that code over to C#, you don't have that problem, even on Android, because you don't have these tiny little objects all over the place. Now, that said, you can still create lots of tiny objects. You could create maybe URLs or strings or, I don't know, handles to something.
Yeah.
And in those cases, the GC will kick in. And what we've done, what we've done is we've done two things. One, if we're building an incremental collector, so that people can use today. And what that does is that as your application is doing some work, we do a mark phase while you're chilling out. So we try to do that collection before it becomes a problem. So the pauses are small. And the second thing that we do is that we have a generational collector. And what that does is that the new objects live in this space called the nursery. And it's very fast to scan the nursery. And the thesis is the following, that many objects are short-lived.
Yeah, you create really a tree of objects, and these are the leaves of the...
Yes. So basically, the theory that you have objects that will stay for you for the long time, right? Like your childhood friends. And then you have people that you meet at a JavaScript meetup. Those guys you're going to meet that day, and then tomorrow you're off to the next meetup, right? So essentially the idea is that your long-term friends you're going to put on the old generation, and that's the one that takes longer to scan. But the nursery, you just scan and throw garbage very quickly. So the pauses are a lot shorter on the nursery. So if you're creating lots of tiny objects and you fill up the nursery, we essentially scan it very quickly and throw all the garbage away and just put the objects that basically stuck around, we graduate them to the old generation. So that means this object is somebody that you care about, like maybe your UI picker, you know, the UI picker for your photo. So that one you're going to be using, we're going to put it at the old generation. But all the little junk like buttons and scroll views and labels for the screen, we're just going to get rid of them. Right. So
can you set the incremental reaping to be time-based, or is it always like I'm going to do X number of objects?
It is. The garbage collector takes care of that. We don't really offer the – I mean, there's a lot of configuration options and
– Yeah. No, I'm just curious, not from a user point of view, but from an internal point of view. Like, does it measure – what's the atomicity of an incremental reaping? Is it we will do X number of objects, or I will spend Y amount of time trying to clean up?
Yeah, we should offer some more options, but we don't. There's already too many options.
I'm sure.
It's a good suggestion. We might add some more options you know, spend these many milliseconds on this or don't spend more than that.
I'm not even sure which one would be better. I'm just curious as to what the...
Well, so we play a lot with these parameters, and the problem in general with memory management techniques is that you can prove that the other one is worse.
Right.
In general, you find that with every paper that deals with memory management. You can always prove that this one is better than the other.
Right. You can always find a pathological case that just makes it
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And there's actually a really interesting paper that basically shows that you can make any that kind of has a semi-mathematical proof that you can make every sophisticated enough system converge on the other approach. Yeah, so you can make them converge on – no, you can make them converge in time and speed depending on how you tune it. In particular, they basically look at reference counting and generational collection, and they say And they say, you know, at the end of the day, you end up with two systems that are almost have identical performance
profiles.
And it's an interesting claim. I don't think that Objective-C is affected by some of the downsides because Objective-C doesn't try to resolve cycles, right? It's up to the programmer to do that. But systems that use reference count and then try to resolve cycles end up being a little bit like generation collectors.
Right.
And generational collectors that try to be as fast as reference counting end up having some of the downsides of performance, right?
Right.
Because, you know, ARC, when you say A equals B, you know, it used to be one assembly instruction. Now you're running some, I don't know, 60 or 70 instructions to do that. So eventually they both converge, right? Eventually you converge on those two things.
Where do you see this kind of stuff going over the next few years? Because I imagine you've got a roadmap ahead of you a little bit, but this is also the kind of thing where everything changes so quickly. You know, we've got 64-bit in the phones now. You probably didn't expect that for another year or so. Or at least I didn't. Like, that seemed a little bit further out than it actually turned out being.
I remember a friend of mine told us from ARM, he's, hey, you know, there's some, are you guys ever considering doing 64 bits?
Yeah.
Would you like guys to, you know, explore 64 bits ARMs, under NDA? I'm like, you know what? I don't want to sign NDAs now. I don't like to sign NDAs.
And it's always, honestly, it's always more of a hint than it sounds when they actually tell you, right?
Yeah, but he didn't make it sound that way. He just said, hey, you know, we're doing this. You know, we've announced that. Would you guys like to know more? I said, listen, we're the mobile experts here. No company's going to put 64 bits on a phone. And, you know, the day that Apple announces that, I sent him in like, hey, can we sign that paperwork now?
Right.
So, but anyways, they made the documentation public at that point.
Yeah.
Yes, that was a very interesting development. I think that for the future, I mean, we'll keep doing C# and we'll keep, you know, assisting developers to use C# and be happy on both platforms. We also support the Mac, by the way. Yeah. But there's a lot of excitement now with F#. And I think the excitement comes from the fact that your programs are, you know, a third of the size of C#, and they're very powerful. So, well, I'm actually not very good at F#. I have to admit, I don't really understand some of the source code that I see out there. It is definitely a very productive language. You really write a tiny, tiny fraction of the C# code, or, you know, compared to Objective-C, it's laughable how tiny this thing is. So there's a lot of excitement actually in F#, and we're trying to bring support for this into the you know, as a supported platform now into the product.
Right. Can we just recap quickly what F# is? It's a functional programming language that runs atop the same CLR that .NET and Mono does, right? So it leverages the base stuff that we were talking about with the garbage collection and the IO abstraction and all of that. But it is, the language layer itself is totally different.
Right. The language itself is inspired, it's inspired by the ML lineage. So it's that ML functional language then became object, ML. There was a version called OCaml.
Yeah.
And from OCaml, they did, okay, what do we need to do to make OCaml a first class citizen in .NET? So that's the heritage of F#. And, so that is the heritage of F#. And the other thing that to me is very interesting is that the guys behind F# went through a lot of trouble at Microsoft to decouple F# from Microsoft. So they've transferred the ownership of the language to the F# Foundation.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So now even the main developer of F# says, please don't call it Microsoft F#. I went through a lot of legal trouble to give it to the world. And
what's the status of C# on that? Is that similarly?
Oh, so, yeah. Well, there's a difference. C# today has two implementations, the compiler. I mean, two major implementations and about 20 or 30 smaller ones. But in production, you have the Microsoft C# compiler, which is proprietary. There's an upcoming C# compiler written in C# by Microsoft called Roslyn. In Microsoft, you know, they've been working on this for a couple of years. And then there's our open source compiler.
Okay. Right?
So those are the three implementations, the three major, implementations of the language. And then the language itself is maintained. The spec is maintained by ECMA, the DCMA. Same thing that maintains
JavaScript, right?
Exactly. And tape standards and all kinds of other standards. And eventually ISO. So we're actually right now working on the next edition of the language, you know, standardizing everything that has been added to the language. And, you know, it's a
and
fun
you guys get a seat at that table, right?
Yes, yes.
So it's not just Microsoft guys. And
no, there's actually a bunch of people there. There's about 20 people that participate in the standard now. And I think we got a really good crowd this time around. The last time it was many years ago, so it was a smaller team, but this time around there's a lot of interest in C#. So it's a much larger team. So that means that we're also making progress a lot faster on knocking items out of the, you know, there's a lot of, you know, like any spec, there are bugs, right? So people say, hey, in page 24, you say Unicode point, and in page 100, it's Unicode unit. Yeah. Which one is it?
Right.
I was like, oh, it sounds about the same. It's like, oh, no, those two things mean different things, right? So there's a little bit of that. So there's a standard, and that's ECMA and eventually ISO. And then there's the implementations,
cool.
Right? With F# is different. There's no standard, but there's an implementation which is unique, and it's open source. So
Okay, so it is what it is kind of thing.
Yeah,
effectively what Objective-C has kind of grown into in a weird
way that
didn't really mean to, but yeah.
What's fascinating, though, is that the community that they've built around F-sharp is massive. It's one of those communities that very few open source projects achieve this level of success in terms of external contributors, and F-sharp got there. So kind of our interest in F-sharp is driven by people really adopting the language.
Yeah, I keep hearing more and more about it, and it feels like dark matter to me. Like I don't kind of know where it gets used or what software it'll ship in, but I keep hearing more and more buzz about it. Do you have any good examples of kind of what?
There's a bunch of apps. I mean, like I said, I don't really keep up with all the mobile apps, but there's a bunch of Android and iOS apps already using F-sharp. Mostly where I hear a lot about it is people doing CAD/CAM, graphic intensive applications for scientific uses, finance people, science people.
I could see that because it doesn't seem to lend itself well to sort of UI event loop kind of thing.
Well, that is a funny thing. In fact, it does lend itself very well to UI. That's what I said. When you build a...
The await thing?
Yeah. Well, actually, that is another funny thing. The entire revolution of awaiting actually was created by the F-sharp people. Those are the guys that invented it, and then Anders Helsberg at Microsoft stole the design. But it was all actually invented by the F-sharp guys for precisely this problem. So for UI, I mean, you would be surprised how tiny the code is. And those guys are actually quite, you know, they'll very proudly show you how your iOS code can be, you know, a fourth of the size of your current code.
Yeah. I'm going to have to check that out.
They're very combative. They're very passionate about their language and their strong evangelisms. So if you tell them, hey, can you make this shorter? They'll prove that they can.
Is that a means to an end for itself for you? Because, I do feel that I've been past 10 years. I've been spending too much time in Objective-C. Before that, I did a bunch of game programming for over a decade, and for many, many years, I kept up with a bunch of platforms, which is how I knew what you were doing on Linux. I was a FreeBSD guy at the time, but whatever.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm maybe missing out on a bunch of this stuff because I haven't really kept up on it. But I'm now so accustomed to reading and writing Objective-C code that. Brevity for the sake of brevity doesn't interest me that much. Like it doesn't feel like a win all the time.
Yeah, I think I was a little bit like that. For example, I always said, what is the point of link, right? When C# introduced link, it was like, okay, that works for databases, but why would I use it for anything else? And it was actually Mark Safar, my key maintainer for C# compiler, that actually drove the point. And I don't know that I'm going to drive it as well as he did, but he said the difference is with traditional programming, you're telling the language how to do things as opposed to what you want. Mm-hmm. So you're always, you know, you want to extract some data. So you say, all right, I'll loop over this thing and then I'll loop over that thing. I'll compare these things. I create a table to extract these other things. Like, you know, you do all these kind of data processing.
Just busy work.
Yeah, busy work. So loops, and is the value this or that added to the list, or did I find it over there? You know, extract unique elements. And when you use these functional languages, and link is actually just a C# incarnation of these functional concepts.
Yeah. Language integrated natural query for anybody at home that wants to.
Yeah, sorry about that. Link stands for language integrated query. And these are ideas from the functional people that kind of now we take for granted. Like MapReduce, right?
Right.
So it's really about saying, this is what I want to achieve. So you are very descriptive. You say what you want, not how you do it.
Mm-hmm. I'm still allergic to regex.
Oh, yeah.
I know it has nothing to do with it, but you can say the same thing about regex, right? Like, well, just express what you want. And it's just gobbledygook. I don't understand it.
Yeah. I guess the best way of looking at it is just looking at some samples of how you process data, or how you do certain things with the language. That is very eye-opening because you kind of declaratively say, this is what I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the compiler has to figure out how to get that for you. So there's both an optimization angle to that. And there's also just the fact that the code is more maintainable, that you're actually saying, this is what I'm interested in, not necessarily how you get there.
Yeah, I will say one of the things about optimization that if you haven't done a lot of it, people may not grok immediately, is that the higher order you can express a problem, the more room there is for optimization below your level of expression.
That's right. That's right. And that's why Fortran also was so easy to optimize back in the day for high-performance computing, because with Fortran, the compiler knew this is the index variable. It's going from this to this. Yeah. And you're not going to be messing around with it, an assumption that you can't really make with C, right?
Right?
So it took less effort to make an optimizing Fortran compiler than it took to implement alias analysis in C, right?
Right.
So there's those elements, but it really comes down to being reading source code and understanding what it does, instead of having to every step of the way try to figure out what is this loop doing, right? So
right.
You move from a world of having loops everywhere to do things with your data to descriptively say what you want. A little bit like reactive programming. I don't know if you've
yeah, I have a little bit on that. There's a project called Reactive Cocoa, which I've looked a little bit at. I like the idea. I think it may be shoehorning something cool into Objective-C where it maybe doesn't fit, but I applaud the effort and I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, it is. I'm not too familiar with the Cocoa version of this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not too familiar with the Cocoa version, but I'm familiar with the C# version. And
can
it's
you explain
fascinating.
The high level idea is something happens and you react and you don't have any state, right?
So, it's a little bit like this. There's these processes. The entire reactive framework is built on the idea that instead of having things that you enumerate, because enumeration is a naturally a pull operation, right? So you have an object and you say, get me the next object, get me the next one, get me the next one. You create it into a push model where you say, well, notify me when this happens,
mm-hmm.
which of course works wonders with things like UI programming.
Yeah.
So the way that the architect of Reactive describes this is that there, he has a word and I forgot it now. Shit. I don't remember the name.
Stateless.
But they are duals. There's a duality. So they're the exact opposites of the same problem. So what he did, the idea was built on the idea that the IEnumerable interface in C# had an exact opposite. And he called it the IObservable interface. So instead of enumerating, you observe.
Oh, I like this. That's trippy.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That's like space-time can be looked at from two perspectives.
It is. Okay. And if you get a chance to listen to the presentation from Eric Meyer, it is fascinating. He does a presentation with coins, actually, where he throws coins at the audience, right? And says, okay, observe this. But what is interesting is that once you do this, you say, okay, there's going to be these events that come in here, and you can subscribe to these events. And you know, that's interesting, but nothing that you haven't done before. What is interesting is that he created an entire composable set of operations. So just like link, actually, this is a very good, there's a very good symmetry here. Link composes objects that are enumerable, right? So when you iterate over your array, you apply filters or select data or group data or do those sort of things. And the exact opposite of link are operators for observing. So he created an entire stack of operators to observe. So you subscribe and you say, hey, listen, I want to observe this thing, but don't send me more than this many objects per second. And make sure that you apply this filter first. And once you do it, throttle the data so that it comes at this rate. And only do it when the user has tapped here and tapped here and tapped here, right? So all of a sudden, so you start composing as rules and describing what is the outcome that you want.
Right.
So in this particular case, there's fascinating examples that they show, and how I'll give you this one, which I really like, is you have this app that has to, as you're typing on an entry line, it renders a list of suggestions, right? But the suggestions come from a web server. So when you type the first letter, you want to go check on the website and say, hey, is there any completion for the letter A? And it would say, yes, I have these completions, right? But the reality is that you don't want to send the letter A. You want to have a little bit more than one letter. B, you want to, maybe if you have a pending connection, don't send a second one, unless 50 milliseconds, 500 milliseconds have passed, right? So the way that you write, the way that you would write this with pure,
C-sharp, Objective-C, what have you.
Yeah, with, what do you call it? Procedural approach,
sure.
Right? Is you would have, when you have this, then call this thing, and you have this, call this thing, and you start managing state, right? It's like, oh, do I have a pending operation? Well, you have a Boolean flag or a date, an NS date representing the time when you send the operation, and you start queuing these things, right? Then you start keeping track of the state over and over. And what you do with observables, it's really one statement. You say, observe input when you get at least more than one character, throttle it, and once you have that, send this request. And then if you get another one, cancel the request. Right? It's a single statement that describes the problem.
It's the criteria. It's the criteria describing the problem rather than...
Yes. And you can mix and match, right? You can use the stuff that you're familiar with, but in the one piece where you want to do to be more descriptive, right, about what you want, you can use that.
I think it makes sense.
You have to see the demos. They're mind-blowing. And you don't need to use C# to use them. You can use your Objective-C language that you're comfortable with. But that is the idea behind a lot of this F# work and link work and functional-style programming.
I think it's the future. As in, like, you know, the desktop will be written in functional programming-ish ways. Or is that – I mean, it's always a goofy question to ask, but – I think
a lot of people are getting very, very comfortable with these ideas. I mean, people are already comfortable with Link. They're getting comfortable with reactive programming. They take a little bit getting used to because
inverse the problem, right? And yeah, go ahead.
You and I have been writing code for, the old way for many years, but young programmers immediately pick it up. It's like, why would I want to do? I mean, we're glorified bookkeepers at this point, right? Yeah. So why do you want to be a bookkeeper? You want to focus on the innovation. You only want to do the bookkeeping if you have a performance problem. But until you have that, you really want to innovate in the UI. You don't want to be spending 3 days fine-tuning your get the suggestion from the remote server, right? Here's how you do it. Now let me focus on my animation to be perfect, right?
That sounds great. I also think we should probably just stop hiring new programmers so that we don't have to learn anything new. I think that's probably the best way to go.
I see what you're trying to do. You're trying to raise your wages.
Exactly. Yeah, of course. It's always the smartest
limited
thing to
supply.
Do. Yeah,
limited
stop,
supply.
Right. Yeah. Stop learning stuff and just dry up the supply. Perfect. It's going to work. Mikhail, thanks so much for chatting. It's been really great. I should point out that everybody should go right now to Xamarin on the web. I'm trying to find the actual address right. xamarin.com. There's a bunch of guides there about getting started with C# and just take a look at the Mac one at least, because I'm sure most people here are Apple people, and it just makes sense. From an Apple perspective, you can read through this little guide and you're going to understand exactly what's going on. And it, definitely worth checking out. Anywhere else where we can find you, Miguel?
I'm on Twitter, Miguel de Casa.
Yeah. You're a lot of fun to follow on Twitter because you're opinionated.
Yeah. It's a blend of technology and making
social
fun of the NSA. Yeah,
yes.
Some of those things. Oh, this NSA thing is fascinating. Fascinating.
Yeah. Shh, don't talk about that.
That's okay.
We're gonna get
thank you very much for having me, guys. This was a lot of fun.
It was great. Thanks a lot, man.
Perfect. Thank you very much, guys. Have a good day.
You too.
Take care.
Bye-bye.